Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome back to New Books in Jewish Studies. I'm your host, Max Kaiser. We have a great show for you today. With us, we have Paul Hannebrink, Professor of History and Jewish Studies at Rutgers University. He is the author of the new book, A Specter Haunting Europe, The Myth of Judeo-Bolshevism, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press in 2018. Paul, thanks very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Brilliant. So first customary question on New Books in Jewish Studies. How did you come to write this book?
Yeah, it's actually, for me, a long story. It was something that came into my mind actually already when I was working on my dissertation, which became my first book on the idea of Christian nationalism in Hungary. While I was in Hungary doing my research on the dissertation in the 1990s and then in the early 2000s when I would go back to do additional work, I noticed some very interesting correspondences between the kinds of language I was seeing in a lot of the sources I was looking at for that dissertation, language about that explicitly linked Jews to the Bolshevik Revolution in Hungary in 1919, and also to the communist regime after 1945, and how this was a very much a deeply rooted historical theme. And then I was also seeing in the public discourse at the time in Hungary this really sort of charged debate among people looking back on the 20th century from their vantage point after 1989. Of the role that Jews had or did not have to play in the history of communism in the 20th century of the country. And so I saw this very interesting dialogue between the past and the present. And I knew that this wasn't specifically a Hungarian phenomenon, that this kind of debate was going on in other places as well. And so I wanted to try to get a purchase on the long durée of this idea, this association of Jews with Bolshevism, or you know what I'm calling the myth of Judeo-Bolshevism. Obviously, not only I, but many people call it that. I wanted to do it in a sort of European way, not just to do another focus just on a Hungarian national topic, but to try to get a sense of the ways in which this idea circulated across borders and was picked up and imitated in from one place to another and passed from one group to another around the continent and even ultimately across the Atlantic. And so that's how I came to think about a book on it, and I was able to start work on it once I finished that earlier book.
Great, fantastic. So we might get into the contents of the book and give the listeners a bit of a tour through how you've tackled these themes. So firstly, you sort of write about how the idea of Judeo-Bolshevism came about in response to the Russian Revolution and the ensuing civil war. Tell us, about the genesis of the myth of Judeo-Bolshevism.
Yeah, I mean, that first chapter is really my approach to the problem of the genesis, because as I was thinking about how to start, what I decided very quickly I did not want to do is to try to go on some quest for the first utterance of anything that might be called Judeo-Bolshevism or the first association of Jews with revolution, because if you start to do that, you quickly start to see the association that is made in the late 18th century between Jews and the French Revolution. And then before that, going well back into the medieval period and earlier of Jews with sort of, disorder and unrest and the ideas that the world might be turned on its head. And so rather than kind of doing a genealogy that could very quickly take me back a very long time, I decided to look at its moment of explosion in Europe in and around the time of the Russian Revolution. And the way in which I try to situate it, both in this chapter and then in the second one, is during the time of World War I and the revolutions that followed, and to show the links that are made between wartime fears of Jewish subversion and Jewish disloyalty, which you can find in many different countries in Europe, and how quickly these kinds of fears morphed into fears that the disloyalty, Jewish disloyalty, might manifest itself in Jewish revolutionary ambitions.
You then turn to look a bit at the interwar era and how Christian churches and nationalist and fascist movements in Europe mobilized the idea of Judeo-Bolshevism in their anti-communist politics. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, well, in this part of the book, I'm really kind of interested in the different ways in which anti-communists approached or mobilized the myth of Judeo-Bolshevism for different kinds of purposes. I mean, one thing to give your listeners is just to start with, what is it? This is, a conspiracy theory. It's a variation on sort of the age-old idea of Jewish conspiracy that somehow Jews are plotting to gain power, not only in one place, but around the world as a kind of global conspiracy. And it is a way of making it very specific to some political phenomenon of the 20th century, blaming Jews for the creation and spread of communism, and also therefore ultimately for the crimes committed by communist regimes. And so there is a wide spectrum of anti-communist politics in the 1930s, across the continent. People who, firmly believe, firmly convinced that communism is evil. And there is this very, widespread language that associates Jews with it. But there is, some very real uncertainty about, what it would mean if everyone makes that the centerpiece of their anti-communist politics. Does that mean that everyone is also agreeing to every other aspect of anti-communism? And this really comes out in the 1930s when you can start to see Nazi Germany positioning itself as, the foremost bulwark against the spread of what Hitler, quite openly calls Judeo-Bolshevism. Many fascists across Europe enthuse to this, and they sign on to this idea of crusade, and so do many religious conservatives as well. But one of the things I do try to show is that there is a very tiny voices within the Christian conservatives in Europe, very small groups, especially among Catholics, who are a little bit concerned about the racial implications of doing that and prefer to think about anti-communism in different ways, and ultimately come up with the notion of totalitarianism as a better way to express it. And so I use Judeo-Bolshevism in this chapter as a way of exploring the overlap, but also the cleavages among anti-communists in Europe at that time, showing, and in particular, the deep investment that the Catholic Church as an institution, also national Catholic churches in many different parts of Europe, have in the idea of Judeo-Bolshevism, but also the kinds of concerns that raises about whether or not they're becoming too close in other ways to fascist movements.
Great. So, yeah, you mentioned the particular way that Nazism, the Nazis took up this idea of Judeo-Bolshevism and refashioned it. Can you tell us a bit more about this and maybe a bit more about, you also then go on to talk about how there were sort of further changes in how the idea of Judeo-Bolshevism was deployed by the Nazis after the invasion of the Soviet Union?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I can take the first part of your question first. I mean, one sort of, you know, scene that I have in the chapter on the 1930s is the speech that Hitler gives at the Nuremberg Party rally shortly after the Spanish Civil War has erupted, in which he talks about the evils of Judeo-Bolshevism. And at the very same time, within days, there's a meeting in the Vatican where the Pope welcomes a bunch of Spanish clergy and bishops to the Vatican, and in which the Spanish clergy are there to try to get a kind of support for their vision of what the Spanish Civil War is about, in which they also use this language among the Spanish nationalists of a Judeo-Bolshevik, they would also add the word Masonic, plot or conspiracy to overthrow the real Spain. And they're disappointed that the Pope doesn't quite go as far in condemning communism in the language that they would like him to, as they would want. And so you can begin to see this sort of, this question of exactly how should communism be imagined as an enemy, and how central to the imagining of communism as an enemy is this association that it has had with Jews and with Judaism. And, you know, from that, I trace out the sort of dissenting voices that, you know, within the 1930s and into the 1940s, there are not many of them to be sure, but they take on an outsized importance after 1945, because they're the ones who really can kind of set the tone in the post-war era. If we look then forward into the war, I mean, one of the most interesting things about the Judeo-Bolshevik myth is the way in which it can become a kind of common ground on which different kinds of fascist groups can work with Nazi Germany, at least early on in the war, when it seems clear to everyone, inevitable, that Nazi Germany is going to win the war and that there will be some kind of new Nazi-imposed order in Europe. And you can find, you know, fascist organizations across, especially in Eastern Europe and occupied Eastern Europe, you know, Ukrainian nationalists, Lithuanian nationalists, who are very eager to work with Nazi occupiers because they think it will serve their visions of their own national future. And the language in which they do this, and the language in which they can express these common goals and act on them, is this language of Judeo-Bolshevism. They can both, with the Nazis, see communists and Jews as being intertwined enemy groups who need to be eliminated, which is why you can find so much support during Operation Barbarossa for the kinds of mass killings that are a feature of the invasion from the very first hours.
So turning from the war, you look at the post-war era and the way, firstly, that communist governments had to deal with challenges to their authority by the entrenched association of Jews with communism. Tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, you know, one of the things that, you know, I found really striking as I was reading about the relationship of the communist regimes in Eastern Europe, and I should say that the ones I focus on most particularly are those of Poland, Hungary, and Romania, although I do mention others at specific moments, was how much communist regimes had to deal with the legacy of the Judeo-Bolshevik myth as it had been used in the politics of the region before the communists came to power. The people whom they were trying to win over to the communist vision of the future, on whom the legitimacy of the communist project depended, were peoples and populations that, you know, were quite familiar with the association of communism with Jews, who were quite willing, many of them, to see Soviet occupiers and Soviet authority and the newly strong communist parties as being an alien and a foreign power, which could then very easily be expressed as a Jewish power. And so the communist regimes had to acknowledge that this was so, and they had to somehow find ways to grapple with it. And so you see a variety of things. You see them sometimes turning a blind eye to anti-Jewish violence, especially immediately after 1945. You see them condoning and at local levels even using well-known anti-Semitic stereotypes to win over people. So you can see, for example, communist officials making distinctions between honest labor and dishonest labor to win over the working class, making the kinds of distinctions that would have been readily understandable to people at the time a reference to the honest workers who belong to the nation and those who do not and those who were alien and therefore Jewish. You see communist regimes finding ways to put some of the most prominent former fascists on trial and executing them in people's courts, but then also finding ways to welcome in many people whom they called "quote unquote" little fascists, people who had been, involved in lower levels in the former fascist regimes, who could find their way into the new era if they were willing to, conform their biography or their sort of CV to what was required of them. And so you find former fascists, entering into Communist Party membership and being included in numbers that actually surprised some communist leaders. There's a famous quote by the Romanian communist and she was Jewish too, Anna Pauker, who was surprised at just how many former members of the Iron Guard were admitted into the Romanian Communist Party, and she noted that the size of the number took her by surprise. And then these were the kinds of considerations that the communist parties faced as they were trying to establish their regimes and trying to establish its legitimacy in the first hours. Going forward, there's a very real concern about the number the perception that the Jewish Communist Party members, especially at the top levels, were making the entire system seem illegitimate to people. And so you find people who style themselves as national communists, Władysław Gomułka in Poland, for example, insist and quite openly that the new communist regimes have to connect themselves and root themselves more firmly in the quote unquote native or national working people rather than turning to foreign or alien elements to lead them. And this was a kind of strategy by which they could force out their opponents in the party, whom they described as cosmopolitan, and which was another word for Jewish.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. So you turn in the next chapter to look at the West during the same era. Mm-hmm. And how anti-communism was reimagined in part through a new idea of Judeo-Christian civilization. Mm-hmm. So tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, this was something that I was noticing in some of the text that I was reading, and I sort of wrestled myself, you know, whether it was related. And I decided that in the end, this was an important facet to the story. One of the things that's quite interesting, and it's rooted most firmly in the United States, although you can certainly find manifestations of it elsewhere in Western Europe, is a migration. One way I think of it is the migration of this adjective Judeo from the Judeo-Bolshevism to Judeo-Christian civilization as a different way of expressing anti-communist politics and of the relationship of Jews to anti-communist politics. In the United States in particular, and you know, during the war years and afterwards, there was a very firm conviction that sort of took root in the political establishment and also, within sort of wider, leading intellectual leaders that what communism's main evil, what its core was its opposition to the kind of values that were derived from religion. And that by setting itself up as a kind of opposing religion, it was destroying the kind of foundation on which the values of an ordered a liberal civil society were built, which were religious values and religious morals. And so, there was a very clear notion that these were certainly to be found in the Christian traditions, but they could also be found in the Jewish tradition as well. And so the idea of Judeo-Christian civilization was a way of expressing the fact that there was a kind of common set of vague religious principles on which civil society was founded, and which had the very consequence that Jews could definitely be included in the anti-communist project. What's kind of interesting is that even if this is the most evident in the case of the United States, and then in the ways in which they try to bring this across the Atlantic after the war, in some of their re-education campaigns of the late 1940s and early 1950s, you find that this does have a kind of echo in the a very particular small group of conservative Christians in the late 1930s who are trying to wrestle their way through imagining what anti-communism might look like that was not founded on a kind of racial idea and that might include an opposition to Nazism as well as sort of two twin totalitarian evils. And, you know, it, as they try to do this, one of the ways that they draw this distinction is by saying that, you know, Nazism is a kind of racial idolatry that is contrary to basic shared, you know, Christian principles, which they acknowledge were originally derived from, you know, Jewish origins. Now, this doesn't necessarily mean that there was a tremendous sort of rush to rescue Jews during the Holocaust, for example. It's really a very intellectual debate about the place of race and about the role of Jews in Christian civilization. But it is a kind of opening, if you like, that, you know, gets a very different kind of centrality in the years after the war, after, you know, Nazism has been definitively defeated and after the sort of fascist alternatives are off the table in most places in Western Europe. Then you start to see this language resonate more clearly with this sort of Judeo-Christian idea as the way to imagine anti-communism.
Great. So finally, you look at how the ideas of Judeo-Bolshevism have been resurrected post-1989 in struggles over memory in Eastern Europe. So tell us a bit about this.
Yeah, I mean, this is in some ways the chapter that reflects, you know, one part of the initial, my initial impetus to explore this project because, you know, it is very striking that the issue of Judeo-Bolshevism and of the connection of Jews to communism is live most vividly now in Eastern Europe in debates over the past, and especially in debates over the Holocaust and over the history of the Holocaust and how the Holocaust should be remembered. One of the ways in which many on the right try to minimize or displace the significance or importance of Holocaust memory is by saying, well, you know, Jews committed crimes as communists, and there is a kind of a cause and effect relationship. And so that cause and effect relationship between violence against Jews and Jewish communist violence against, you know, against the sort of the local nation, I guess is the way they would put it. You know, have this kind of effect of feeding on each other, and that the Holocaust has to be understood in that kind of context. And that has the very real consequence of serving as a kind of way of signaling opposition to what I think is the sort of civic project behind Holocaust memory. That is to say, remembering the Holocaust is not simply an exercise in historiography. There's a history of its creation as a goal, which I try to sketch a little bit in this chapter, so that remembering the Holocaust is about you know, things that we might loosely describe as sort of liberal values in society, that it is connected somehow with ideals of multiculturalism, ideals of respect for human rights, and that, you know, remembering the Holocaust is a kind of shorthand for these things. Many nationalists believe that, you know, these ideals of multiculturalism and respect for human rights are things that have been brought from the West, for example, through the European Union, and that they do not take into account local national conditions and the specificities of national history. And so, you know, reframing Holocaust memory in this kind of relational way to the crimes of Jewish communism is one way of pushing back more generally at the broader liberal project that Holocaust memory, you know, kind of signals or signifies. And so for that reason, it seems to me that it expresses itself in debates about books, but, you know, these debates about books like Jan Gross's Neighbors, for example, you know, have these, you know, much wider social resonance as well. And I think that social resonance has to do with, the kind of, you know, deep ambivalence about, the wider significance of Holocaust memory that is fairly widespread across the right in many societies, particularly in Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's all really interesting. So thanks very much for giving us sort of a brief tour through the sort of central ideas and themes in the book. I am interested to ask you about what the reception has been for your book, because, yeah, obviously, as you mentioned, it does come out, I guess, particularly maybe in the US context, a very the political importance, I suppose, or the political contemporary political resonances are certainly very obvious. So, yeah, if you could tell us a little bit about how it's been received, that would be awesome.
I've been flattered and gratified by how well it's been received. And I think, I can't take any credit for the sort of moment in which it came out. I mean, I began to work on this, I began to think about this book, you know, already, as I said earlier, in the 1990s, and I really began working on it in earnest, after my first book came out in 2006. And so I was working on this, you know, through 2006 to 2010s, right? And, it's really in the last 2 years or so, 3 years, that, you know, since 2016, that, you know, you really start to see this resurgence of, what is now being called, you know, the alt-right or the new right, or, you know, in the United States and elsewhere. And one, you know, feature of it has been, and you saw this on display in the rally in Charlottesville, in the attack on the synagogue in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in the attack on Jews in Poway, California, is this, resurgence of fears and of a global Jewish conspiracy. And I think, you know, what my book is, it's not a sort of a diagnosis of the moment of, you know, of our present, but it is, I think, a very rich examination of one very specific historical manifestation of this, you know, fear of a global Jewish conspiracy. And I think by seeing how it can operate and how it can be appropriated and how it has been used, because I think that is important, sort of how people use it and what it means to them when they do use these anti-Semitic stereotypes, what they think they're saying when they do this, what they think they're doing when they do this. We might get some purchase on why these stereotypes and these antipathies seem to be back now in certain ways, and why, for example, a figure like George Soros seems to play this outsized role in the imaginations of so many nationalists when they decry globalization and they, you know, lament all of the evils that globalizations bring with it. You find the face and the figure of George Soros coming up very often. Now, clearly, George Soros is, you know, quite the opposite of a communist, for sure. But there is this kind of, you know, sense that he is somehow, you know, a symbol of this conspiratorial thinking that has had a very long history, and whose twists and turns of that history, I think, are worth revisiting and worth reflecting upon.
Absolutely. So, yes, definitely very timely and I think important intervention. So definitely thanks very much for talking to us about your book today. Just before we let you go, I was wondering if you could tell us a bit about what you're working on next.
Yeah, to be honest with you, I've only just begun to think about this since this sort of, you know, consumed the better part of a decade of my scholarly life. You know, if I might be honest, I spent so much time thinking about this that I began wondering about sort of the other side of things, and so now I'm really been looking most closely of late at people who describe themselves in the 30s and 40s as anti-fascist, and what became of them in various places after 1945, and what became of the idea of anti-fascism in different parts of Europe, both East and West, once the Cold War descended on the continent. So that's the theme that I'm exploring now, and I'm looking for ways to sort of dig into it in more detail.
Oh, wow, that sounds really brilliant. So we definitely hope to have you on the show again to talk about hopefully the eventual book or project. But yeah, for now, thanks very much for being on the show. So you've been listening to New Books in Jewish Studies with your host, Max Kaiser. And today with us, we had Paul Hannebrink, Professor of History and Jewish Studies at Rutgers University. And he talked to us about his new book, A Spectre Haunting Europe, The Myth of Judeo-Bolshevism, published by the Belknap Press of Harvard University Press in 2018. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.